Greetings, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, broadcasting live from the East SETI Ranch, also known as the Paranormal and UFO Central. We've got a great show tonight. I want to talk about a few things beforehand. We did have that 8.8 quake that hit over there in Chile, and when they do have major quakes in Chile, Hawaii gets the tsunami reports, and the last one they had, I think, was the April Fool's quake, where they had a pretty big tsunami come through there, you know, from Chile. And it's not over yet. I mean, Chile is rocking and rolling, and so is Argentina, and so is a lot of the surrounding areas, Peru. They're all having experiences right now, and this is all escalating, and definitely we've been warning people about, you know, being along the coast during these times, because the earth is going to be moving quite a bit. But, heads up on that one. Luckily, there's, I guess, a 3-foot swell came through, tidal surge, and that was about it. But they were expecting a 9-foot plus, and luckily it was diminished. Hopefully the kahunas over there were doing their thing and taking the energy out of that that incoming wave. But speaking about kahunas and shamans, I've got a great show tonight. I've got Max Christensen. He's a Kunlun master. We have his website up on the site there. It's primordialalchemist.com if you want to check it out. And I've taken his teacher's training class and been taught Kunlun, and it's an amazing art. And without any more on that, we'll see if we can bring Max on the show. Max, are you with us?
Hey, James. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Good. I was nice and cold.
Yeah, great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, there's so many things. You're involved in so many things. I know you brought the Kunlun practices to the States here. Now, how many people did you say you had practicing Kunlun in Japan alone?
Approximately 10,000.
Around 10,000 people. That's amazing. And you've been teaching it internationally all over the world. And I don't know how many you have in the States, but I'm sure there's quite a few in the States as well. But, basically, there's so many different ways we can go this, because you not only teach the Kunlun practices, you teach the Mongolian shamanism, you teach the Egyptian classes. We could probably go in 10 different directions, but, you know, let's begin with Kunlun, and maybe you can give us a little bit of a history of where, you know, this practice or this art originated.
Originally, Kunlun means top of the head, the path of no more learning, the land of snow. Kunlun, the way I've named it, is because I have many Taoist teachers. Many are from Mao Shan, we call the Shangqing sect. And the Kunlun itself, there's a Kunlun Pai system in China, which is a martial art. It's a Taoist tradition. But I call it Kunlun because I want to represent many of my teachers, you know, give honor to all of them. And the main part of the Kunlun that we've taught over all the world is composed of one practice is we call the Red Phoenix, which opens up the dormant potential of the brain and the wisdom eye. We call the Crystal Palace. And then there's the spontaneous, we call Yizhong, which is a spontaneous type of movement that opens up all the dormant potential of the body itself energetically. The Qi system, we call your chakra system, opens up all the nadis, the channel. And so when you combine the Red Phoenix and the spontaneous, this is a way of you to obtain what we call Gold Dragon Body. And in Gold Dragon Body, you call the Wu Dragons of China. The Wu Dragons are very famous for their body of, we call the Gold Dragon Body, which is equivalent to the returnable rainbow body of the Tibetan system. And so that allows their body to go from mass into energy.
So it's basically an ascension process.
Yeah, it's an ascension process that opens up the dormant potential that's in every single person. And there's people who are young as 6 years old who has learned it, and old as 75, 80 years old have learned it. And a lot of people have very, very good health. Within about 15, 20 minutes, if they do it correctly, there's the body starts to open up. We speak in tongues. You get very hot, very cold, spontaneous body posture. They'll have the wisdom eye open. A little concept called the little death, where the back arcs, and there's five levels of ecstatic bliss, and then the wisdom eye open, but outwardly, the person looked like they had died. Mouth is open, eyes looking up, No breath, the outer breath disappears, and the inner breath becomes apparent.
I bet you that freaks out some of the people when they're observing that. You know, it's like, you know, I've seen some of these things happen, everything from, you know, like you're saying, people to go into spontaneous bliss and you know, end up on the floor, to going out of body, to having, you know, spontaneous healings, to you name it, just being around Kundalini. As little as I have, I mean, nothing compared to what you've been experiencing, but anyway, from what I've seen, it's a pretty amazing process.
Yeah, well, for most people, their health is the first thing they notice gets really, really good. You know, the kidneys regenerate because their qi becomes more stronger. Then the glands regenerate, and then the body works from inside out, gets stronger and stronger.
And it's a real inner practice. It's not an intellectual thing. I know a lot of people, you know, want to engage their mind, and it's more of a practice of no mind, wouldn't you say?
Yes, well, it's what we call a letting go of the form becoming formless. And if your mind's there, like a scholar, and you're actually observing it, it's detrimental, you know, because your mind, if you just surrender, have that childlike nature, just be more playful, you know, then it starts having its effect, and you fall into it, and the body moves itself. The blocks come out by you just observing it.
And, you know, I've seen, as we said before, I've seen people on the ground, they'll be shaken when their energy channels come out, start opening up. I mean, I've seen so many different processes, and it seems like there's as many things happen as there are individuals, you might say.
Yeah, it does, because based on, you know, how you were raised, your environment, seeing the magnetics of the land, there's so many variables. But we say in our tradition that you're doomed to succeed because, you know, most people, you know, they say as long as you're a human being, you're doomed to succeed. You will master it in some way or form. But most people, they're very happy just feeling this blissful feeling, feeling very healthy. For them, that's their form of awakening.
And some of the effects that people, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about that as some of the experiences that people have during this process, or is it better just not to talk about it and let each person have their own individual experience when they do the practice?
Well, we say the direct experience is the best because, say, if I tell you my experiences, it will never be the same as yours because, again, everybody's unique. So nobody will have the same experiences at the same time. Some will go from the emptiness into this full movement. Others start from movement and then go into emptiness. Other people, you know, it's, again, based on what they want, the end result.
So it's almost like whatever they are seeking, or whatever their inner nature is going to manifest, or even their external nature is going to create some kind of an experience for them. You know, be it hitting the ground, you know, and shaking like a worm, or just the basic aha, you know, like.
Well, the movement is just purification. I mean, you know, that's not the whole concept. People think movement, like they shake and they feel bliss. Bliss is only meaning that you're on the path and the seed days, the attainments you get. But the thing is, it's going to the emptiness, you know, not get attracted into bliss. A lot of people like a bliss junkie, you know. They like to attach the feelings because most people, they never had a chance to feel that good. So for them, you know, it's hard to let it go, but it's part of the path. But, you know, each person, again, will have a different experience from another person. Some take longer to open. Some take a little bit shorter time. That's why it's divided into, we say, the long, long path, and the long, short, the short, long, the short, short, the short, quick, and the quick, quick.
Now, I know in yoga they talk about, you know, some people are like wet wood. No matter how much energy you throw at them, it's going to take forever for, you know, they need to dry out a little bit, you know. And some people are like, you know, basic wood, and you can get it lit, you know, but it's going to take a little work. And then other people are like kindling, and you just throw a match on them, boom, they explode, you know.
Yeah.
And it's probably pretty much the same thing that...
Well, each person has their own natural element. Some people more like fire, some people like water, some like air. And so what happens is that, say, if you're a fire person, you've been on the teeter-totter, you know, one side for a long time. So to awaken, you become the opposing element in order to find your balance, we call the middle path. So you'll end up being more like water element. And so when those two elements are in balance, we call fire and water, mm-hmm. or the Taoists call Kan and Li. There's a, when the fire and water mix and there's a balance, there's a steaming process. In our Taoist alchemy, that's like we call heating the cauldron. And this mm-hmm. allows you to convert what we call your essence, your jing, into qi, which is your life force. And then it, when that you get this qi built up in the heart, you feel very blissful. But then you must convert that into emptiness. So to refine that steam, it disappears into nothingness. Mm-hmm. So if you do it right in the Kunlun practice, the lower body is very warm, the heart is cool, and the mind is empty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good thing to strive for. I know in my own experience, it's kind of, and I don't know if this relates to astrology at all, but I'm on the cusp of a fire and a water sign both, which is quite interesting, and which would make steam. And I don't know if there's anything relative at all to that with people's signs or astrological signs.
Well, for us, it's not really the astrological signs that we work on. It's more like the balancing of the heart and the kidneys. You know, mm-hmm. that's what we call the fire and the water. Because,
okay.
you know, if those two elements are mixed properly, you know, it doesn't matter what astrological sign you are, or even, you know, like your diet so much, or even like where you live, because it's an internal cultivation. We call the microcosm. And when you balance the microcosm inside yourself, the universe, then the outside naturally takes care of itself.
So if you lean, like when we're doing the moving postures, I mean, the fire element's fun, but the one I most am attracted to is the water. So is it natural to be attracted to the water element if you're fire, if you're basic fire? Would you be naturally attracted to the opposite element, or is that... have anything to do with it? I don't know.
Well, usually that we've seen in the Taoist tradition is that there's a natural balancing. If you're very earthy, you're going to go for the air. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you're more fire, you're going to go with water, because that's the natural alchemy. You know, to create the opposing element in order to balance you, and
mm-hmm.
it can come from your mentally. You know, if you're mentally fire or you're physically fire, so there's a lot of basic variations of the, you know, mixing the elements. But the Kunlun itself, it does the balancing without your mind getting in the way. We say 99% of a one's awakening comes from purification of the mind. And Kunlun naturally, as you shake off the mind, the body will shake off first. But in some people, the body will shake before the mind is released. But either way, it's going to do the same effect.
Yeah. Now, I know there's dark retreats and things like that where they say if you spend a certain amount of time, you know, in a dark retreat or whatever, is that you'll drop all that old programming. Everything just falls away eventually, and you get a whole new neural net, you know, to work with. Is that similar to some of the things that you're working with?
Yeah, like a lot of the traditions I was taught by my teachers, be it in the Tibetan or the Taoist tradition, is I was for 9 days in darkness, because, you know, that's the time where it allows you to empty the mind and then introspect oneself. And then the biochemistry of the mind starts to change, you know. The serotonin and melatonin levels in the brain start to change. And this allows you to see your inner light, we call. And in every tradition, like in the Kahunas, they'll spend, the Peleliu and Kanalu tradition of Kauai, they'll spend 3 days in a lava tube that's closed, and they'll do their practices. And the one I was with my Navajo teacher in Taos, New Mexico, yeah, you would stand being under the ground in a cave or even in a teepee for, you know, a certain amount of time in darkness. You know, the Nyingma Lamas, some of them do dark retreats. Some do for 9 years in the dark in a cave. You know, every tradition does some form of darkness so that you can see the light from within.
Yeah, definitely. I know there's a lot of science now that they're finding out that basically there is a certain amount of time if you spend in darkness without any outer influences or distractions or whatever, that your whole neural net, your old program, just kind of goes out the door and breaks down, and you know, you can get back to that innocence, you know, that wide open innocence that we're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the thing is, like during that time also, is they wouldn't speak, they wouldn't eat. You know, you can drink, but you know, the
mm-hmm.
sleeping and not eating in the darkness does something to you. And a lot of traditions do that kind of a fasting, but you got to do preparations before. And then the hard thing is that once you have experience in this dark retreat, when you come out to the world, you might come back to your same way of thought, because once you start speaking again, you know, you'll come back to that same state of mind. So you have to have a practice to continue it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you ever try for, say, 24 hours, like when I was with my teachers in Taos, New Mexico, from the Red Willow Society in the Pueblo, is a lot of the old medicine people, their way of awakening is they don't speak. And they say for, you know, a long period of time, you don't speak, you save a lot of energy. And I was taught by my DA, which is my teacher, is that we lose 90% of our energy through speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So when I asked my teacher, my Navajo teacher, you know, like a question, they'd use the minimal amount of words for the maximal effect, so that they did not lose their energy.
Mm-hmm. Probably do a lot of hand signals.
No, they just sit there in contemplation.
Yeah.
You know, even saying the fewest words, you know, like when I learned, when I was in that medicine tradition, you know, they'll ask me a question, and as a Westerner, well, I'll just start saying all kinds of stuff. And they all kind of shook their head because I was wasting too much energy in speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you learn the old ways of their awakening, it's just they learn just to keep quiet.
Yeah, I know a lot of them will have they'll just put a little sign on their chest or whatever saying, you know, in silence or you know, in vow of silence or whatever. I have some friends, Lakota friends, that do that, and they'll just go on a silent retreat and then say, I'm not going to talk for a month or even longer. And it just says in silence, and
well,
you know,
if you notice them, like a lot of them will wear the dark glasses even at nighttime, because after a long periods of time of not speaking, their wisdom mind actually starts to open up because they're not leaking energy out.
Mm-hmm. So for the next 45 minutes on this show, we're going to have a silent meditation.
Well, that would be the easiest show you had then.
Yeah, it'd be nice, you know, it'd be interesting to do that sometimes, just say, okay, we're going to have a show here, and we're going to do an introduction, and the next 45 minutes is just going to be silent meditation, and we are doing that already, actually. We are having we have the E-SETI chamber, where we are spending time, and people are all linking up at the exact same time and meditating, and the results we're getting from that is phenomenal, because people are having all these incredible experiences linking up together and sharing in the energy. And they tap into the energy of the ranch here and the other work that we're doing, and, you know, start having beings appear to them, see lights flashing all around them, have spontaneous, you know, huge energy shifts, and, you know, all the way up to spontaneous healings happen. And so it's quite amazing. I'd love to hook this into this other network, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now that I've, you know, retired from the outer teaching, so that's why I'm going to stress more doing more of the old Mongolian shamanism for my first teacher's wife. You know, I feel I've done everything I want to do, you know, in teaching the Kunlun worldwide. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's just now I'm more into the more of the, I say, contemplative arts now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, both of us have a similar desires right now. It's you know, I feel too, I've done my part. But I know there's more work to do out there. But it's like I've taken things to where I wanted to, and now I really want it to get legs of its own, as you've done. You've taught so many teachers, and have sent them out, you know, all over the world internationally, and now they're starting their classes and. You know, continuing in the tradition. So, you know, basically that must feel good to you that you do have, you know, this ongoing teaching out there, this lineage that's being, you know, expanding exponentially, basically.
Yeah, well, I've been practicing since I was formally accepted by my first teacher at 6 years old. You know, he was a mm-hmm. Wudang teacher from Hebei province. And that's why I learned the Qigong and that. And, you know, through my various life, I've been doing this. But now I've been to a point where I feel I'm very comfortable, very happy. I've done what I was supposed to, you know, all mm-hmm. the teachers, the promises I made. And I got some, you know, really good facilitating people out there, like you have one on your ranch, you know. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's very, very good at what he does. So I'm very happy that, you know, they're taking over now.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to get some people taken over for me, but you know, it's hard for people to stay on that path. I mean, you've probably run into that quite a bit. There's so many people that will start off and they learn the techniques or whatever, and then, you know, they'll let it go to their head or get into ego or start misusing the energy or whatever, and then you're back to square one, you know, with you know, having to teach more people and more people to get it out there, and hopefully it'll stay clean, you might say.
Yeah, we say many call, few are chosen. But, you know, like a lot of people, you start in the beginning, but again, many people don't want to go all the way to their own full awakening. Most people are struggling enough just getting their health. And so, you know, and they got family life, and they got job, and they got, you know, situations where they're not like at the temple in a monastery. And so when they practice this way, again, what's so nice about Kunlun is that you can practice and you don't have to surrender anything. You can be the way you are, like a layman.
Yeah. Would you say that practicing this Kunlun, I know it builds your life force up and your available energies, you might say, but let's say if somebody, a good example is like we talked earlier about that was my brother. He's been doing massage and other martial arts all his life, and now he's just focusing mainly in healing practices. And he did the Kunlun. As soon as he went into the position, he just started like shaking, going, "Holy smokes!" You know. And then half an hour later, he had a client, and he put his hands on her head to do a cranial sacral move on her, and she just went in total spontaneous bliss and then processing heavy duty. You know, crying and just major release, and it was quite shocking for him. So it seems like this energy that we're building up will enhance what other healing work that you're doing, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, because what happens is you're building this overabundance, you know, and so it's radiating outside the body. A lot of people, we say in China, my aunties in Beijing who are also Maoshan practitioners, they say energy healers die young. Because the more you push your energy, what happens, your kidneys take the strain first. And say, example, if a man pushes too much energy on the right side of the kidney, you know, feel like a belt going around the waist, they'll get the shooting pain, while women will get it on the left. And this means that you're giving too much energy out. And so that's why they'll feel exhausted after. But with the Kunlun, what happens is that the energy, you have the overabundance outside. You're not draining your body at all. So actually you should feel quite refreshed. And as I was at your brother or brother-in-law, when he did it, the overabundance, which was outside, went to the person who needed it. And then, you know, when she was ready, based on how ready she was and how open her mind and heart was, is what happens to the body. And again, the shaking, the movement, means that the channels are being opened up.
Yeah, so her energy channels were being opened up so she could receive the energy or just the abundance of energy that's a byproduct of that flowing through your body?
Yes, because a lot of sickness just basically is when the channels start to close up, because either the mind closed up first or the body. And so this just allows you to kind of flush the hair out of the drain, we say. You know, so that way you're more clear, then the body can naturally heal itself. Because when you're young, say when you're young like baby, your glandulars are very, very strong. So you're very, very, very healthy. But as we start to progress through life and age and stress, the glandulars are not as strong as we usually were when we were young. And so to compensate, you take a medicine, you know, to regenerate that. But then you take so much medicine, and it's not part of your own natural body, your body forgets how to heal itself. So Kunlun is like a person coming in, like a wet dog coming in. You know, they learn the posture, they let go, the body starts to shake, like a dog shaking off the water. And then the health starts to regenerate.
So when you cough up the hairball, you're okay.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you'll notice, and you probably see it in the Kunlun classes, that some people who cannot speak their truth, they'll start to cough.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's a fear. Or their chest is very caved in. It's because, you know, they have not had the possibility of opening themselves up. So this helps them to open.
Now, the system is different than a lot of the yogis talk about, the seven chakra system, but there's basically, there are three maybe dantians that you work with in your practice?
Yeah. Well, most systems are fire-based. They go from the tailbone up. And we're one of the water-based systems, and it's also called in China, another practice called Sika, the gold flower, or the nine palaces, is the water path. Mm-hmm. And the water path comes from the crown down into the body and then down into the tailbone. And so what happened, this is what we call cooling the fire before it arises. So mm-hmm. at the same time, as above is below, as the law of nature, as the crown opens up, your tailbone opens up. As your wisdom eye center open up, then you got the lower abdomen, the lower dantian, which is behind the belly button. And then as your throat opens up, the solar plexus opens up. And then eventually that energy meets at the heart. And we say when emptiness of the mind and the blissful radiance of the spontaneous energy arises into the heart, we call the middle path, or we call the blooming of the gold flower. And when that heart opens up, and that's when you have this kind of a death experience, you see this very bright light, then the mind, the lower mind, we say in between the, you know, in the head itself, it starts to descend through a channel called Katika channel. In Tibet they have this. It's called the channel of clarity. And that energy flows down, that mind, your lower mind we use every day, flows down and meets with the heart. And this is when they have their great opening, where bliss and this compassion come together.
And the now one of the things I notice with a lot of the Kundalini yoga and things like that are raising the Kundalini. It's a very powerful energy, and when it comes up, a lot of people end up with energy sickness, or they have a severe block or whatever in one of their chakras, and when the energy comes up, it really lays them out. But this is a whole different process, is what you're saying.
Yeah, in China, they call it Xiang Kung, or Qi dispersion. A lot of people who do the forceful method, some people do a lot of Bastrika, and then maybe forceful breath holding. And, yeah, we say the fire path is easy to open, but it's very easy to damage yourself if you don't have the guidance of a proper teacher. While in the water path, my teacher says they only need to see you once, but you continue the water path. Everything is, it opens up naturally. It's not forceful in any way. And, you know, your body, your kind of higher mind dictate, and nature itself dictates, you know, when you open and how you open and how much you open. The thing mm-hmm. is to get your mind out of the way when you're practicing.
Yeah, I see. It's always good to use this process with the presence of a trained master or even an ascended master on another level. You might want to invoke, you know, one of those guys to kind of watch over you during this process. But you know, who knows? But I noticed when I was in the Teachings of the Inner Christ movement, and that movement, the Tibetan Foundation, there is that they would bring in the higher beings, the ascended masters, and they would oversee to make sure you didn't take on more energy than you could handle. They would kind of monitor the shift that happens, and you know, so people wouldn't go into that Kundalini shock or have that problem. And I guess just by doing this other practice, that avoids that altogether.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the water path is not really known as much as the fire path. It's pretty safe. You know, it's mm-hmm. a gentle approach. And so you can control it at will. You can slow it down. You can, it's malleable, you know, mm-hmm. based on the practitioner. And in the old days, there wasn't, you know, the teacher wasn't had to be there 24 hours a day. You know, it's, we call it the path of no more learning. I mean, everything that happens in Kundalini will happen to you naturally. Say, example, as you sleep, you're unconscious, but yet your body goes through the same processes. This water path descends into you. That's how the body regenerates itself. And again, people are just not aware of what they really naturally already have. And the Kundalini reveals this to you.
And so it's basically, we're trying, probably using the intellect a little too much here, trying to explain this process.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of people, just sitting down and shutting up and doing the practice and just let the energy do its work.
Yes, because, you know, we're used to controlling, like in yoga, that we're used to, our mind is used to controlling what the body should or should not do. But mm-hmm. but based on your mind, it's different every time you practice. It's never the same. So, and based on the time of day, you know, or the season, you know, every Kundalini time is going to be different when you practice. Sometimes it may be a little bit of movement, sometimes none. And sometimes you buy a will, whatever you need at that moment, your highest mind, your highest potential that's dormant within you, you know, that decides what you need. If we think, well, what do I need? It's like saying you know yoga. You have countless postures, and it takes a long time to practice each one. So if you knew, if your body has a natural yoga in it, when you do the Kunlun, it naturally takes the posture you need for at that moment. And sometimes, even when you're not practicing, it's usually the effects happen after you practice, the manifestations. You say you're walking across a street with the people, and if something's not really good for you, your body will shake for a moment and kind of shake that away.
Yeah, so you're moving in. Now I noticed that, let's say if I was a beginning practitioner and I sat down and I assumed the posture, you know, the base Kunlun posture, and the energy started flowing through me, what might I, you know, expect to happen in, I know we shouldn't have expectations, but what are some of the things that usually happen to people?
Well, okay, most time the very first thing is that people think too much, so they'll get a little bit, oh, why doesn't it happen right away? If you look for it, we say it'll move away from you. The moment you don't grab for it, it'll come to you. So usually the first thing is your legs will start to shake. And, you know, like, you know, you got the nervous leg syndrome people have these days and doctors don't know what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so they give you a pill to stop this movement. But naturally, when people start to awaken, their legs are going to start to shake. Now, from the shaking, basically if it's coming from your lower body's movement first or your upper body, sometimes the head may move first in a circle. And then you may start to shake very, very fast or slow. Again, each person's different.
Mm-hmm.
From here, most people get very, very hot or very, very cold. When very hot, that means your electrical system of your body is being purified, while the cold is the magnetic potential, which is dormant, is starting to flow. We say your shushume in your central channel.
Mm-hmm.
Then from here, usually some people, when the energy works in the brain, you have different scent. Lilac, rose, different things of purification. This is coming from you.
Mm-hmm.
Then one may hear high sounds. Then one may see flashes of light. The body will take spontaneous postures, almost yogic in nature. If you're the type of person who's very fiery, your body may build up energy, but then all of a sudden you'll get drawn to the ground, almost like a magnet or a vacuum, so that the extra energy you have, or if it's a sickness, purges out through the earth. And then eventually it'll stop, and nothing will happen. That means you've opened up for that time.
And I know when people have this major opening, and then they sit down the next time and nothing happens, they go, what's wrong? What am I doing wrong? And I think it's important to know that maybe you're doing something right, because it you're there. You've gone through that opening, and now you're where you need to be.
Right, right. That's why each time you practice is going to be different. It's never going to be the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know with me too is when I got sick. I got really sick down in Mexico, and then when I did the Kunlun, I had to go. I went through a lot of the same processes that I went through in the very beginning, and I think it was because my energy levels were so low, and because of the sickness I was experiencing, and it just burned it off again. It, you know, went through a lot of the same process.
Now, sometimes, though, like in purification, the hardest part of the body to purify is your brain, because it's encapsulated.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people, how you know that they're on their level of attaining more of a higher level of awareness, is if you imagine like a baby, the frontala, the top of the head, is very open, very soft. But then as we get older, it closes and locks very, very, you know, solid. But then at the moment of death, the cranial bones open up, so that we say the spirit, the Shen, can leave the body. When you practice Kunlun, the crown has a tendency of getting a bulge at the top and a crack. Similar to what we call Po in Tibet, where there's a space enough where you can put what we call a piece of kushka, grass, you know, in the crown itself. And what it means is that also you might sometimes get a yellowish discharge or a bloody discharge from the top of your head. And it's very sweet. It's like spinal fluid. That means you're successful at opening the crown. At other very rare times, you'll get as my Navajo teacher says, we'll cry tears of blood. And sometimes you'll get this black kind of sulfury tears coming out of your eyes. That's the toxins coming out from the brain. At other times, you get the soma, the elixir of immortality, this very thick honey-like fluid that drips down your throat. And it can be white and clear or golden color. And this will then you swallow that soma, and that allows the body to reawaken itself, to heal itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that coming from like the pineal gland, or where would that be coming from?
Well, in the Taoists, we call it the crystal palace. And mm-hmm. in the crystal palace, mainly we got the pineal pituitary. And mm-hmm. when those two are vibrating in sync, that's when you create the soma.
Okay.
We call it the elixir of immortality, the peach of immortality, you know, the elixir of life, you know, the jade elixir and the other Taoist traditions. And that's when that nurtures you. That's when that gives you life itself. The water of life, that's another way you can call it.
So it seems like once that opens up and starts happening, your body will probably go through a major transition, you know, some kind of a frequency transition or less dense physically, you might say, or is there some other words you might use for that?
Well, it's more of a finer matter, you know, in a physical sense. You'll feel like, as I see my teachers, gray hair turns black, wrinkles start to fade. You know, you feel, your body feels very regenerated, like in yoga, like, you know, you get more subtleness in your muscles. You feel like a 24-year-old again. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, you just feel very, very fresh, you know what I mean? You don't feel like an old piece of wood anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to do a little more practicing on that one.
Yeah, but again, you know, and the thing is that, you just, in our tradition, I just tell people, you know, practice 1 hour a night. Mm-hmm. You know, evening time is the best time, around 7:30 p.m. to 9, anywhere between there. And that allows your body to calm. It allows you to regenerate. If you mm-hmm. want to do between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m., that would be the time for spiritual endeavors. You know, mm-hmm. most people, they wake up, find themselves waking up between 3 and 3:15 in the morning. You know, that's when all the spirit gates are open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want for your, strictly for health, practice anywhere from 5 to 7 a.m. in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm finding myself, when my energies are getting down or not feeling healthy, that's what I'll do is I'll automatically get up early in the morning and do it and go out and sit in front of the mountain and practice Kundalini. And now that the snow is gone, it's even better. But like you're saying it, now a lot of people are waking up at 3 or 4 in the morning right at that time, and I'm getting so many emails from people and even phone calls from people saying, what is going on? Why am I waking up, you know, every morning at 4 in the morning or between 3:30 and 4 in the morning? It seems like they're waking up.
Well, to us, that's the time where the most spirit doors are open, the time for you to really, you know, be able to tap into the spirit world itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the time where we call yin and yang, within our tradition, is balanced, like, you know, the spirit world and the physical world. And that's where a lot of the old traditions, where the old masters would come and teach you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, you know, and that's what I was telling people, you know, also, too, a lot of times when you hear that ringing in your ear, there's a high-frequency communication going on that's going straight into your subconscious. And it would seem logical that that's when these masters are working with people, or, you know, extremely advanced ultra-dimensionals or whatever, or even ETs are teaching people at that time period, or it could be any time during the day when you're in any kind of a meditative state or whatever.
Well, in the Taoist traditions of sleep yoga, they say if you follow the sound back to its origin, then you go back to the source of Tao, you know, the great mystery. So
mm-hmm.
if you're the type that has a ringing in the ear, you know, just lay on your side and just listen to the sound, and the less you listen to it, the louder you'll get. And eventually try to follow the sound back, what we call like nada yoga. Try to find back the sound where it originate from. And this is mm-hmm. where another type of what we call dream practice that the Taoists do.
So, yeah, following that back. Now, following that sound back, would you, I guess it depends on if you're clairvoyant or not, would you have an image of where it's coming from, or I might say a being or whatever that might be the origin of that sound?
Well, eventually, once you trace the sound back, then from the sound eventually will get loud as a roar as an ocean, and
mm-hmm.
then it will start to fade and disappear. And then from there, you start to see light. And then you trace the light back to where it comes from. And so that's the process we say returning to source in a mental,
mm-hmm.
in a more of a mental practice of sleep.
And tracing the light, when you start seeing the lights, and you start tracing the light back, you know, again, that may originate from a light being, you know, who knows, or somebody trying to, or just the source itself.
Well, there's many manifestations, you know. Sometimes it's from what you call your masters, but other times it's like you're seeing your own inner light. You know, we call the illusionary light, or those who we think is real, and then there's what we call the clear light. Mm-hmm. And what happens basically is that, give an example of a near-death experience. People see a tunnel of light. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look in the Tibetan tradition, like in our Nyingma, if you had your wisdom eye open, and a near-death experience that naturally opens up, and you see this tunnel of light, well, some people think they're going out the crown. But we say that's the outer, as above, so below, as inner, as out. We perceive we're going up or out. But in actuality, is the wisdom eye looking down through the Katika channel. And that's in Tibetan yoga. And the Katika channel means channel clarity. Your inner eye is actually looking down to the place of the heart, which is where the true spirit of one's person is, mm-hmm. where the origin is. So actually, you're traveling through that Katika channel back into the essence, you know, within your own heart. But as a more material aspect, if people are not aware of the channel inside themselves, they will perceive their channel as they're traveling outside the head into a tunnel above them.
Yeah, I've heard over and over again people talking about the tunnel of light is actually your spinal cord, you know, the moving up and down your spinal cord. You know, it sounds like what you're talking about, very similar, but not so much a physical, not as physical as your spinal cord. It's more of an energy cord, you might say, that goes from the heart to the, through the crown. Is that what you...
Yeah. Well, you always say your spirit, your lower mind. You say your mind we use every day, is we call it between the eyebrows. But what happens is that when a yogi starts to go through his kind of spiritual death and awakening, that mind part of him goes to the center of the brain called the crystal palace,
mm-hmm.
and from here he descends into this Katika channel, and then it goes to his heart. And that's where, if you ever look at a person or seen a person who's died, the average human being loses about 5 ounces of weight when they die. And mm-hmm. the light is from the heart. You know, that's that spiritual essence we call the pearl that never dulls.
Mm-hmm.
And even doctors, you know, there's a part in the heart, some specialized cells that a doctor, even a healthy person, from what I've heard, will never prick that part or touch it because
that
can create a shock. The person, and this will allow the spirit to leave. And there's an actual Taoist practices where they actually touch that with their mind, much like we call the red sun practice. And the red sun practice mm-hmm. allows you to kind of merge your lower mind and higher mind into that reality, that part of the heart. And what happens, you get this kind of energetic, blissful hiccup when you've actually touched it.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's I know what you're talking about. They said a lot of times you don't want to touch that with any instrument, especially a metal instrument or anything else, because that wherever you're operating on would you can, you know, you create an instant death by
even a healthy person that. Would leave.
It's not a good idea to touch that area. Now, one of the teachers I studied with, he said the soul sits in that area, and the soul, that's what leaves the body when you die, and it's through the heart that you connect to the source. It's not through the mind. The intellect is just a drop in the sea of consciousness. But
Right. A lot of the other traditions call that same method a drop going into the ocean of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
The ocean of wisdom being your heart. It was like in the Tibetan tradition, and your mind is like that drop. We call it to enter into the primordial awareness, you know, mm-hmm. unmanifested thought and unmanifested space, as the Taoists would tell you. It's the same kind of meaning, you know, going back into the heart.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you heard about these latest experiments where they actually found in the pineal gland the same type of receptors that would be in your eyes that are actually in the pineal gland, and they're connected to a place in the heart, which is quite interesting, and they've documented this, they've found it, but they don't know how it operates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of new sciences now opening up that, or talking about that, you know, quantum physicists are trying to explore it, and even a lot of the quantum physicists, I had a few that actually learned, you know, the Kunlun and trying to mm-hmm. incorporate, you know, the quantum physics, what they know now, with the ancient practices. It's like a lot of the old Taoists were kind of the first quantum physicists. They could apply it but couldn't really understand, like, the scientific value like they have now. You know, they watched mm-hmm. nature. But now the modern quantum physics, they can explain it scientifically, but they're trying to apply it to the body. So if you actually mix the, if you were like a quantum physicist and you mix that with this, and you weren't too scientific first, you know, let the mind go with that and experience it directly, and then you could probably even figure out even deeper aspects of quantum physics.
Mm-hmm. No, I know I had one of the people I went to, he's one of the guys in What the Bleep, one of the physicists there, and when I met him quite a few years ago, he was saying that, you know, there is no way to experience these other dimensions, and there, it would take too much Planck energy to get there, and there's just no way that you can bridge dimensions. It's the energy levels it would take are impossible, you know, to experience these other dimensions. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. I said, we're actually filming the other dimensions opening and being stepping out of these dimensions and everything else. And I said, what about that zero point energy that everybody has within us that we can access? It's the same energy that set whole universes into motion. And why would that not be enough Planck energy, you might say, to do any of these practices, like you're saying, like bilocation or, you know, ascend the body or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of these methods, like, say, the red phoenix from the Maoshan tradition, you know, I've had quantum physicists talk about it with me, and they found that, you know, you're actually accessing a zero-point energy in the center of the brain. We call it a zero, like inside a crystal palace. It's almost mm-hmm. like a zero-point energy, and even in the heart itself. You know, it's a vacuum. You know, like a bindu, they say in the Indian tradition, it's actually a vacuum, and you're accessing that vacuum. And, you know, if you get a power of a vacuum, you know, it allows a lot of energy to pour forth from you.
Mm-hmm. I know in the vacuum or empty space, they say there's something like 10 to the, I don't know how much power of available energy there. People think that the void or zero point or whatever you want to call it is just nothing, and it's actually not. In a huge, it's a space of there's so much available energy there. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, even in the Egyptian school of Tet, school of Anubis, it's a yogic order. They talk about accessing that very type of energy in the between the wisdom eye, between the eyebrow, by utilizing a method called the Sa breath. Mm-hmm. And that was an ancient practice that even if you read the pyramid text of ancient Egypt, they talk about the Atlantean culture, you know, and they talk mm-hmm. about how they've the had this arc, this particular power, and that's the arc is one that Anubis sits upon. And mm-hmm. they talk about how they used to access these seven component parts, both externally and internally. It was a kind of a biomechanical understanding, you know, how to develop that energy in the body. And so they would talk about Anubis's daughter Ketemet, and she was inside that box where Anubis sits upon. And she was the one that could access that power, you know, that go through your body.
Mm-hmm. And so he was utilizing her as a bridge, you might say, or a...
Well, Anubis represented, like, the primordial awareness, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, also the dormant potential inside yourself. And Ketemet was the daughter, and she was represented by a black cobra, we call an asp, mm-hmm. you know, and you travel across, and then you see Anubis on a sunboat, and Anubis mm-hmm. would be traveling across the River Nile, which represents your spinal cord. And when you see his daughter, it represented two serpents that were walking next to him with feathers on their back. And then as he got to the River Nile, then you say after he went to his awakening, he became Ra Osiris, the awakened man. While mm-hmm. a man in the old school of Anubis was called a mummy, an unawakened person.
Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a lot of the mummies running around, or muggles, or whatever they call them on the planet right now.
Yeah. But, you know, and their school is very interesting. You know, like their symbology, like the vulture represented transfiguration or change, the condor. And mm-hmm. you see him in a lot of the temples, like in Abydos, you'll see him holding this ring of power called the Shen. It's funny because Chinese Shen means spirit, but it's mm-hmm. like a ring of power. And even some of the Babylonian pictures, you see a king, it looks like a half with wings, and then it looks like a lion's body holding this ring of power.
Now, I wonder if that goes back to, I know there are these felines, and Sekhmet actually, what do you know about Sekhmet? Sekhmet was actually a lion humanoid being, you might say, or one of the gods there.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the school of Osiris, Sekhmet represents also the divine potential in the body itself. you know, mm-hmm. in your soul card, in your body. Sekhmet was the divine serpent energy. Mm-hmm. And so also, when they saw the cat, like Basque, the cat was more protection. So you can look at it in a lot of their pictures as they were protectors of the person undergoing their trials of awakening. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, the way the modern Egyptians talk about it and the way that, you know, like the school of Anubis, it's so different. It's not like, you know, what the scholars talk about.
Oh, yeah, so definitely. You know,
he was a lawyer. And he had a tea house in California before he retired. And the Egyptian priests, you know, they came up to him and they knocked on his door and says, okay, we're here to teach you. And he had no idea that was from his past. And how they recognize you is they make you hold your hand up. And if you have really long fingers, then it showed, okay, you're from the school of Anubis or school of Tet, or they call Tat. And then, you know, there's other signs that they'll look at you, physical signs.
Mm-hmm. And I was just looking at my hand, and I have really long fingers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but not too much is written about that, or the Sabra. Yeah. You know, in Egypt, that's kind of forbidden word. You know, you read about mainly in the pyramid text.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the coffin text that has some hints about it also.
Yeah. I know in ancient India, they called them Narsringa, which were the felines or whatever, and they would, same thing, they would call on them for protection. And there's some very ancient stories about bandits coming into a town, and they would pray to Narsringa, and these bandits would just get knocked off their horses, and their clothing would get torn and shredded, and they'd go running off into the jungle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I personally, just like the movie Avatar, from my own personal experience, I know these beings do exist, and they are on other dimensions, you might say higher dimensions, and they will step in if you need help sometimes and kind of watch over you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, you got to be at that certain level of, you know, you might have to be open to those realities, you know, also, you know, if you're very closed-minded, you won't get very much from what I'm understanding. You have to be open and have done some, you know, spirituality. You have to meet them halfway in a way, you know, to show
exactly.
that they really are serious about it.
Yeah, I know even the scientists have proven that you actually see with your brain, you know, and a lot of these people are really negative because, you know, they say, you know, I'll believe it when I see it, but it doesn't work that way because if you don't believe it and if you don't have no desire to experience that, you're not going to have that experience. That's just the way the brain works.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty similar to, like, when you have people, you know, want to see the your extraterrestrials, you know. You can have a person right next to you very scholarly, but then they won't be able to see it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I've had these experiences when I was much younger, is that what I was told is that your brain resonates at a certain frequency when you're open. And so they'll mm-hmm. modify their field, and they can shape the field of the ship so that you can actually just make it so only you see it, but the person next to you cannot. That's why a lot of people... You'll see them like in the city below, and they're not even aware what's above them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see that happen here quite often. You know, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's just been an incredible interview. I know we could probably talk for another 5 hours on all this. But so the best way to get a hold of you for any upcoming workshops or classes or whatever would be to go through the Primordial Alchemy, or is it Alchemist or Alchemy?
Primordial Alchemy. Alchemist.
Alchemy. Yeah, .com.
Yeah.
And then they can contact you there and find out. And we have that link up on the BBS site, too. So, mm-hmm. Do you have anything coming up very soon that people might want to know about?
No, Pan. I'm still in transition right now, you know, in new location. And probably within the next few months, I will start up my classes again.
Great.
And there'll be more on more of the Mongolian shamanism from the, you know, the Buta China, which is the Blue Wolf tradition. And then they'll doing more of the Egyptian actual, you know, practices from the school of Tet, the school of Anubis. And, you know, besides maybe like tea classes, because, you know, I'm an advert Chinese tea drinker, so I like to teach tea classes.
Oh, yeah, that was great having the tea this evening. Well, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Have a great evening and hope to see you soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio signing off. Have a great evening. Good night.